This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on May 5th, 2011. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The next item on our agenda is a policy regarding disclosure of documents and information in the enforcement process. Vice Chair, we have some late submitted documents.
Thank you. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 11-23, 11-23A, and 11-23B.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries 6-0. We have several members of our General Counsel's office joining us here at the table to answer any questions that commissioners might have. This agenda item was placed on the agenda at the request of the Vice Chair. It's a procedure that the entire commission has been discussing for some time. I'll turn it over to any of my colleagues who wish to discuss any of the documents before us. Commissioner Walter.
I'll be glad to get started. This is a policy that we have discussed for some time, and pardon my voice. I hope it doesn't fail me because it has occasionally weakened on me. This policy is something that I was surprised, I guess, in time in various instances that we don't have, and that's really a policy, internal written policy, on when we will or will not, and to what extent we provide respondents with information regarding matters which are being investigated for possible violations. And in a recent case, it became starkly apparent to me that we needed a policy like this, and I felt that we should begin to draft one. The most agencies, I think, have some parameters by which they embrace the disclosure of documents gathered during an investigative process. We don't have anything formal like the kind that's before us today. In thinking about that, and one of the issues that came to mind, as I say, also starkly, was the issue with respect to providing information which may tend to be exculpatory in nature or may tend to benefit a defense of a respondent. And there is a Supreme Court case that makes that an obligation constitutionally in criminal proceedings. There are recommendations by the American Bar Association, which are in place in many courts, that impose that as well in some aspects of a professional obligation to, not just a constitutional obligation, to achieve a satisfactory degree of fairness and due process. So in trying to craft something, my thought was to take a look at not only what we generally do that may be negative to somebody's case, but also what's also positive to someone's case. And so this particular draft that I asked for commission consideration basically takes the Brady theory of disclosure of exculpatory evidence into consideration, provides for methodology by which that would be disclosed to respondents, and also, of course, provides for other relevant information that's gathered in the course of an investigation to be made available to respondents. In doing this, there were some matters that seemed to not be quite so clear as I'd like to make them now. The policy that I'm asking the commission to consider does not expand on documents that normally would be, conversely, does not limit the documents that normally would be withheld by us, by the commission, in the form of ones that are privileged in nature, ones that constitute work product, ones that constitute information obtained from other governmental entities for which we have an agreement, or maybe anything, of course, that would be confidential by law. So let me make that clear. It doesn't provide for a handing over of those documents any more than we would do them now. But what it does is takes a look at those other documents and say, okay, let's take the documents that we've gathered in the course of an investigation against a respondent, and what would those be? First of all, there's you take the balance that's left after you exclude those, and so this provides that anything that's immaterial or not relevant would not be included, that anything that's already in their possession is not included, or should clearly be in their possession is not included. Anything that's in the public eye or ascertainable through public information is not included. So then we remove those documents from what needs to be disclosed, and you go down to what's really relevant documents that they don't have that we know we have. They're in our possession, and they're not ones that we go out to seek to get, but they're already in our possession. This provides that there's a time, not a daily instance time where we have to continue to do it, but there is a time during the process by which disclosure would be made. Now, we already say that when we file documents, when we file a probable cause brief, documents that are cited in that brief will be made known to the respondent. Well, that sounds reasonable. But it seems to me that if we're really talking about fairness and due process, there's no institutional reason why our agency should want to conceal the documents we already have which are relevant, which are either favorable to or negative to a respondent who's facing a governmental investigation. If we feel that way, then I don't think we've articulated through our general counsel or ourselves as a commission when those institutional situations exist. This particular document provides for a time when it's either at the probable cause stage or during pre-probable cause conciliation, when those relevant documents would be made available. And this shouldn't come to a surprise that this has happened. This happens throughout the country in a number of prosecutorial areas in administrative agencies. And I would also add, and it's well stated in the document that's on file, that there are federal agencies that have clearly made files available similar in this way, and sometimes at different times based upon their own structure and the course of their investigative process. I think we need one. I think we need to show that we're not afraid to give documents that hurt someone's case that we quite haven't produced yet, maybe because they haven't been particularly asked for, when our investigation is completed, or if we're in a stage when we want to enter into pre-probable cause conciliation. I recognize that this is breaking some new ground, but it's something we do every day. It's something we face every day, and we just do it without really having it in writing, one way or the other. Some things we don't do that I suggested here, but the process deals with each of these issues, and it's really done based upon tradition, some memoranda, and just what's in the best opinion of the general counsel. This also provides for a basis by which the general counsel can come to the commission when the general counsel sees an issue with respect to documents to be withheld for guidance on where to go. Yes, go ahead. Privileged documents, the commission can waive them if they want. We could waive worth product if they want. That would be rare cases. How do we rub up against documents we received that we already have some information from our own and some that came to us from a government agreement or an agreement with the government, which is rare for us, very rare. And the commission can give guidance one way or the other. It does not suggest, and they emphasize that the brief of the Office of General Counsel is inaccurate in this regard, that it might somehow suggest that the commission can override the law. That's not our intention, or any existing privilege, or any existing work product privilege that exists. It simply provides for a method by which the commission can take control of the situation and make a decision one way or the other. The issue has come up, well, golly, can we really do this? I mean, can we really give these extra little bit of documents over to the other side because we're so burdened that we just may not be able to do this? And let me just say, and I've been practicing law for 37 years before I got here, mostly in litigation. This is done all the time. And I do think what it requires in order for us to do it is to have organized files in the office. I can't tell you whether they are or not because I've not looked at them ever that way. But as they proceed through an investigative case and they separate documents that are privileged, separate ones that are work product, separate ones that are, if you want, already known to the public, put those in or take them out. If you want to take them out, you can do that. Ones that are already in your possession, okay, we can take those out because we know you already have them, and leave with a pile. You say, then, all right, what documents would be produced in our probable cause brief? We're going to produce those anyway. So then what else is left if that's what we're talking about? And you find a set of documents there in one table over here, and it can be burdensome at that point to put them over here and say, take a look at them. And you, at your expense, you can copy whatever ones of those you want or do what most lawyers do in cases like this. They'll scan them and give them a CD, and the documents are available. I don't see there's a burden, and certainly I'm sensitive to our own budgetary requirements to do that. If we keep our files organized and know in advance that that's really what we're going to do. We basically do that anyway when we decide what documents we're going to put on for probable cause. We have to pull out and say, these documents or this information is available. What I think it will do is now make it more cognizant that they will be getting some potential exculpatory evidence, for example, or maybe documents that are relevant that they're not necessarily going to put in a probable cause brief that might be relevant to the case, so that the counsel on the other side has the opportunity to do this. So this is my best shot at trying to capitalize those considerations for consideration by the commission. I think it's time for us to do it. I don't think we should be afraid of being among those that are willing to implement the Brady considerations into our disclosure process. I think we're certainly capable of doing it without burdening the Office of General Counsel to such a degree that it justifies concealing documents from a respondent. I think we should consider there's a natural tendency, in my view, on the part of some governments to make it easier to keep documents secret than not to. I think that in our particular case, we're a disclosure agency, we're big on transparency. I think we should do it the same way. How can it hurt us to let the other side know that there's some information that might be favorable to them? If we go to pre-probable cause because we concealed it, and then we're in litigation, they're going to find it all out in discovery anyway, in formal civil discovery in federal court. I don't think there's any document I'm proposing to make available that can't be discovered if we were in federal civil court and under normal federal rules of civil procedure. And the same protections apply there as well. So my view is, I've seen some of the things of concerns. I'm not concerned by those, but I do think there's ways in which we could ameliorate some of those by maybe some clarifying language, maybe ways to consider some other issues that appear when first read could justify clarification. But anyhow, that's my best pitch. I hope the commission will adopt it or something like it.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thank Commissioner Walther for his leadership on this issue and also for pushing to have a written codification of our policy on this. I think that's a really good move for us to do. I've had many conversations over the years with various people in our general counsel's office, some of whom are no longer in the building, about disclosure of exculpatory evidence. And I've always been in favor of it. I've always pushed to make sure that we were doing it. I am not aware of any commissioner that I've ever served of who was not in favor of disclosing any exculpatory or mitigating evidence to respondents. You know, I don't think there's any debate at all about that. And I've been assured at various points over the years that we were doing that. And I think that what happens without a written policy is one person's understanding may be different from another person's understanding, and what I thought two general counsels ago I was told made about this and assumed was still going on may not 100% reflect what's going on today with, you know, turnover in personnel, and one person says something, you know, it's like a game of telephone, what Larry Norton told me and told somebody else and then got relayed to somebody else. You know, it just there just may be completely honest differences as to what the policy is supposed to be. So I think for those reasons, it's really a good idea, and I appreciate my colleagues' efforts to try and get something in writing. I think it's something that we should, we've had a lot of internal discussions about this. I think it's something that would benefit from some comment from practitioners who practice in front of us. There's a couple of us at the table who have sat on the other side and represented clients, and apparently Commissioner McGann actually remembers all of my cases, some of them better than I do. Levin was an ADR case, I'm pretty sure.
Tierney was the murderer.
Yeah. That was one of the MERS. Anyway, you know, some of us have had that experience and some of us haven't, of sitting on the other side and seeing what the experience is like from the other side. And it's illuminating to see it from both sides, as I'm sure my colleague would agree. But I think that I've been on this side of the table longer now than I was on the other side, and I think it would be helpful to us to hear from practitioners on the exact parameters of what we ought to be doing here, and perhaps from other law enforcement agencies as well. One concern that I have is if we have a disclosure policy that is broader than that of other enforcement agencies, such as the Justice Department, how will that affect the level of cooperation that we get from those other enforcement agencies when we're seeking to share documents back and forth. And I know that there's a provision in here that I appreciate very much in Commissioner Walther's proposal that says specifically that if we have if anything has been disclosed to us by another law enforcement agency under an agreement that we're not going to disclose it, then we won't. And I think that's a very good and important provision. I think, though, that it's also possible that we could have information within our possession that we didn't get from another law enforcement agency but might be relevant to them as they pursue a criminal or other proceeding, that they might have a different perspective on whether it would harm the development of their case for us to disclose it at an earlier stage, you know. So I would like to actually, you know, send our drafts over to the Justice Department, to the Office of Public Integrity in particular, and just see what they think of it. Get some feedback from them, because I think that's an important perspective. I think it could potentially affect how the level of voluntary cooperation that we get from witnesses, particularly third party witnesses. We actually it's fairly unusual for us to have to issue subpoenas. Right now we get a high degree of cooperation from people in terms of sharing information with us when we're doing our investigations, and I would hate to see that jeopardized. And I'm a little concerned that you know, one of the proposals in Commissioner Walther's proposal is that we would, whereas currently we share documents at the probable cause phase, we would share it at an earlier stage here whenever we would enter into conciliation. And at the same time, we would basically halt our own investigation. So we would be sharing with the other side pretty much whatever we have in our files. There's a discussion of the Brady Doctrine, but it's not limited to Brady Doctrine cases, Brady Doctrine information. So we would be sharing with the other side all of the information that we have at the time, without getting a lot back at that point, because we'd have to stop our investigation under this policy. And I wonder if that is actually the best way to get to the best informed conciliation agreement at the end of the day that adequately fleshes out all the issues. I think there are some serious and complicated issues around cases that involve multiple respondents. Because, and this happens, you know, we've had cases that had 20 respondents, or maybe more. That one pops into my head because that was a complicated case. So we're getting information from a bunch of different respondents. They each have confidentiality rights under the statute, and the proposal in Commissioner Walther's draft is that we would ask them for to sign a waiver of those confidentiality rights in order to enable us to share this information among respondents. And we would do that on a routine basis. I'm not 100% sure that that I feel comfortable with us routinely asking people to waive their confidentiality rights. It does not necessarily require that we would require a non-disclosure agreement. It says we might ask them for a non-disclosure agreement, but that would require four votes, you know, and we might or might not have four votes at any one time. So that's, you know, I wonder about the position that we're putting multiple respondents, and each one of them has the same rights. Now, sometimes these multiple respondents are all on the same page. They have a community of interest, in which case, you know, I think there is some potential for people to game the system. You know, if there are people who have fairly low-level liability and they know it, they know we're not going to come after them very hard. You know, they might try and structure the timing of their conciliation agreements of their conciliation negotiations to try and get information out of us at an earlier point that then could be fed to the bigger fish in the crowd so that that person would really have all of our cards open to them, although we wouldn't have all their cards open to us when we're negotiating with them at a later point. I think there's an even more serious problem if they have oppositional interests. I mean, we've had cases where we have multiple respondents and they're actually suing each other. At the same time, we're trying to investigate and conduct conciliation with them. You know, I think that they might have some strong concerns about our sharing information that we get from one of them with the other one, people who might otherwise say, you know, I want to be forthcoming with the government, I want to resolve this and get right with the law, but at the same time, I'm going after that other person that I think has done me wrong, you know, they might be less willing to share with us information that would help us resolve our issues at that point because they want to hold back their information to make sure it's not shared with people that they are actively suing. You know, and this comes up actually fairly frequently. We get organizations and individuals. You know, there are individuals acting on behalf of the organization. The organization may claim they were acting without authorization. The individuals may claim, no, you knew exactly what I was doing all the time. There's any number of fact patterns that could involve people with opposite interests, and we may be placing them in an untenable situation where we are, you know, taking information from them and in some cases subpoenaing information from them and then handing it over to somebody that they're suing in court at the same time. So I think we really need to give some thought to this, and it would benefit from the comments of practitioners who are out there representing people who are in these positions. Now, I suspect that a lot of these practitioners will say, wow, this is really great. We would love to have all this information. You know, but I think some of them might, who have represented people, particularly in these multiple respondent cases, may have some concerns about it, may have some positive suggestions on how we could adjust the policy to make it better. So I think it would really, I mean, personally, I'd be in favor of, you know, putting it in the Federal Register and seeking formal comment. But at a minimum, I would think, you know, now that we have made a couple of different alternatives public, we should wait a couple of weeks and give an opportunity until the next meeting to have a formal vote on it so that we can give people an opportunity, should they choose, maybe nobody will, to weigh in and send us information and share those concerns. I will say that the proposal that Commissioner Walther has put forward is complicated. I'm not sure that I actually understand all the ins and outs of it as it's sitting in front of me today. I was going over it again yesterday, and it has evolved, and I think it's improved. But, you know, the reality is we were trading drafts up until about 6 o'clock last night. As a result of that, I'm still not 100% sure that I understand everything in there. And I think that's another reason why it might be a good idea to let some other folks take a look at it and give us their suggestions. I have, in conjunction with the chair, put forward another proposal, which is, you know, a different approach. It's modeled closely on the policy that FERC has And I think is more in line with what a lot of other administrative agencies do. It's modeled more closely on the Brady Doctrine and sharing those documents, sharing them at the probable cause stage. It's shorter. It's a lot shorter. Now, I'm not saying that that policy is the perfect policy either. It's just an attempt to put out a different approach so that when people take a look at these things, they can look at them side by side and say, I like this part of this proposal, I like that part of that proposal, or I have an entirely different idea. I mean, we could, for example, use the rules of civil procedure as a model for what we ought to disclose. That's another possibility. We could look to the documents that we disclose at the end of a MER and say, well, we should just disclose those that entire file at an earlier point. We have been, in the old days, we put everything on the public record at the end of a MER, but we don't do that anymore. We've been told by a court that we can't do that, that we have to have a more tailored approach to disclosure. And I think in this regard as well, we need to have a tailored approach to what we're disclosing, because we're proposing, it's easy in the one respondent case, frankly, because most of the information comes from that person anyway. It gets a lot more complicated when we have multiple respondents. And we're talking about giving people other people's documents. It's not clear to me the way that the Commissioner Walther's proposal is written right now that even at the probable cause phase we could redact personal identifying information. If we had it seems to call for the disclosure of complete copies of documents. It's, if a document was a bank statement or a credit card statement or something that contained somebody's bank numbers or their credit card numbers or their social security number, it's not clear under this policy that we'd be able to redact that. And I think it just requires perhaps a little bit more thought and a little bit of editing. I'm not suggesting that's anybody's intention to do that, but I just want to make sure that the proposal that we ultimately adopt reflects adequate concerns for people's privacy rights. In addition to the confidentiality concerns under the statute, there's also privacy rights that all of us have in personal information that we might not want to be shared. And even if a document is only shared with one other person, as I said, if that one other person is the one person in the world that you least want to know that information, then that doesn't do you much good. You might prefer to give it to the man on the street than the guy that you're litigating against. I think it's a bold Commissioner Walther's proposal is a bold proposal. It goes beyond what most agencies do. I'm not saying that we shouldn't go beyond what most agencies do, but I think we ought to do it in a thoughtful and well-informed way, and that getting comments from people out there who are practicing would help us to craft a better policy at the end of the day, which we're all in favor of, and I'll end where I began. I have never served with any commissioner that was not in favor of the agency disclosing exculpatory and mitigating information to respondents. I think that is a principle that every commissioner has been in favor of. I have certainly been in favor of it. I have advocated for it internally. And I think this is, again, I appreciate Commissioner Walther's leadership in pushing us forward to a place where we codify these proposals and make the proposal itself public. I'll mention one other concern, actually, that I just thought of. There's a new proposal that we would create a withheld documents list, and we'd have to turn over document logs. It's not exactly clear to me, would that include every single email that every staff attorney sent to their supervisor in the course of investigating a case? I'm not exactly sure what the scope of it is. I think it potentially could involve a fair amount of work for our lawyers. I think potentially we could, as commissioners, get involved in a lot of discovery-type adjudication over whether particular documents should or shouldn't have been disclosed, whether certain confidential documents, certain privileged documents should under various circumstances be disclosed. I think that we have some aggressive practitioners out there who will be happy to take advantage of new procedures that we give them for appealing, at least to us, the documents that they receive or not. And that's why I think it would be important to do this as a pilot basis. The proposal that Chair Bowerly and I put forward includes that it would be a pilot program for a year and then we would reconsider it. Actually, I think our proposal probably needs that feature less than the other proposal because ours is more of a codification of what we're currently doing. So, you know, do we need a pilot program to continue doing what we're already doing? You know, possibly not. But I think if we're going to do something new that could turn out to be somewhat cumbersome for the agency to administer and not actually provide a lot of benefit for the cost of the agency, we might want to reconsider that down the road. And that's typically what we do when we do something new, is we do it as a pilot program, and then we give ourselves that automatic opportunity to refine it down the road. So I would strongly urge that if we're going to do something different, if we're going to expand what we're already doing and do something different, that we should do that as a pilot program so that we can adjust it down the road, not with an eye towards not disclosing exculpatory or mitigating information to anybody. As I said, nobody thinks that would be a good result. Nobody is advocating that we not disclose exculpatory or mitigating information. But the policy itself, the ins and the outs, may need to be refined over time, and I think we ought to build that in the way we do with other new programs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to take this opportunity to clarify what I have in mind in this, so that it doesn't take us in a direction that's different in the discussion. And I appreciate Commissioner Weintraub. I know she's been for most of these issues for some time, and I'm hopeful that we can sit here and think about all the potential problems that could be concerns forever, and we'll never get anywhere unless we decide how we're going to do it. And the way I did it is, when we can run up against something that's potentially an issue that we can't really imagine, it comes to the Commission if the Office of General Counsel feels that that's important for us to get guidance. It's not an automatic trigger, well, we'll conceal it. It's a matter of coming to the Commission and saying, something here, there's a potential way our investigation could be injured. We don't think it's privileged, but sensitive, you know, we'd like to get your guidance on it. Or we got information from the federal government, but we also got the information from George over here, and we think because it's available through George, and we can come to us and say, well, run it by justice first. I mean, it gives us an avenue to move to get this done without the automatic trigger being to conceal. For me, there are some things that I think are important. There seems to be some concern about whether or not to provide for discovery at the pre-probable cause conciliation stage. I can see the argument that can be made. Well, somebody will ask for pre-probable cause conciliation to help somebody else out. Okay, well, that would be a rare time. It's possible if we get really nervous about it, we could take that into consideration, but I really don't think that's something that we're going to find ourselves confronted with. The statistics that came to me recently show that in last year, 2011, there were 23 matters that are either in pre-probable cause conciliation or for which there's a pre-probable cause brief has been filed. As to the brief, you know, 90% done. Likewise, for the year before, there was only 16. The year before, there was 31. In an office for a full year's time of over 100 lawyers and staff people, I don't see how most all of this that the commissioner indicated. We do it one way or the other. Either we automatically provide it or we automatically don't, but we don't have a procedure to help us decide how to get it done if there's an issue. I'm not suggesting that we turn over anything for which we have an obligation to conceal. I keep making that clear. For a multiple respondent case, if something is not able to be concealed in a multiple respondent case, it doesn't get concealed to anybody else. It doesn't get exposed to anyone else unless something gets worked out. And then, you know, it could be a waiver, could be a redaction. A commission can say, well, we really got that information from somewhere else. But it gives us a way to not just automatically conceal the information, but to deal with it. I think timing is important, and I think if we decide we're going to wait until after, you know, we've gone to pre-probable cause, that's all great, but is that really fair to somebody who's up against a pre-probable cause brief? and they get into litigation and find out, which I think was a potential interracial matter, they get into litigation and find out, geez, you really knew something fairly, what I could consider to be exculpatory after all. I think we should give people the information, like any of us who would be before a governmental investigation, the information that will either help or hurt your case when it's useful to them. And that's when you're in pre-probable cause conciliation. The whole idea is to try and settle a case. The best way to do it is when all the cards are on the table. We don't really ask at probable cause stage, well, what do you got? We say, what are you? Here's what we have. There's not necessarily an exchange in that case. But we, as the governmental agency moving against someone, has an obligation to make some disclosures. We can't say, give us all your witness list right now, and that kind of thing, but that would come later in the civil litigation. I think certainly, you know, there's no magic to this language, that's for sure. But I do think in nearly all instances for the multiple respondent situation, and instances where we've got information from maybe even a previous case. I think there was an issue. We had one case. We had information in a previous case that we didn't know whether to get it disclosed or not, so we asked for interrogatories to see if we could disclose it that way. These are all issues that we can deal with at the commission level if we need to, because the same issues that will be for us no matter what we do, we just don't have an automatic procedure except the knee-jerk to generally withhold. So, thank you.
Any further discussion? Commissioner McGann?
I hate to do this, Madam Chair. I know it's close to lunch, but I'm going to say just for two seconds, but I'm going to ask for like a 3-minute recess. I'm getting over a cold, and I'm sort of coughing and making a lot of noise, so I hate to be disruptive. But just while we're sort of in the discussion here, I'm glad to hear that several of us agree we need a written policy. There is a current policy, it's just in the air, like so many policies are, until they're reduced to writing, and it has at times been ad hoc, usually inadvertently. Sometimes it depends, you know, who the general counsel was in a particular error and what line attorney you may have been dealing with as to what gets turned over and when. As far as comment, I want to remind our colleagues that we did have a hearing some time ago about agency procedures generally, and this was one of the topics that was discussed, and there were comments on the need for this kind of policy, and we did get quite a few coherent suggestions, and I recall one in particular was quite detailed. Two, we've had real cases. There's cases before I've gotten here, there's cases since I've been here that illustrate some shortcomings in the current policy, and I think Commissioner Walter's right in that at the end of the day, much of what we're talking about are things that really the respondent will get eventually. It's just a question of when they get them. Third, why wait is what I wrote in my notes. And I understand the need, the concern about talking to DOJ and practitioners and whatnot, but as I said, we've already had a hearing. Practitioners have waited on the need for this. Two, we already turn over quite a bit of material at the probable cause stage. My guess is other agencies that may intersect with the FEC's jurisdiction from time to time probably wish we didn't even do that. So that's an issue that horse has already left the barn, so to say. And as a practical matter, dealing with the third party issue, I see that as part of a red herring, because although I could see specific cases where it gets tricky, that doesn't mean the policy is therefore tricky or complicated. And again, to be clear, the informal policy is at the probable cause stage, when the counsel relies on something in its brief, it gets turned over. So you get the deposition transcript or whatnot. The concern is that some think that maybe things aren't ending up in the brief because they don't want to necessarily show the respondent things or not. Whether that's the case or not doesn't matter. But that perception could be there, and that's an important perception that I think we need to address. So we're already we're already operating under a procedure where things are being turned over, even if there are third parties or multiple respondents or the respondents are blaming each other. Those are issues the commission has dealt with for 30 years. The commission will continue to deal with that. And I think Commissioner Walter's proposal has dealt with it in a thoughtful manner, and I think these issues have been thought through. Certainly, could there be an outlier that catches us by surprise? Sure. That's why it's a policy and not a formal one-size-fits-all approach. But it is an important thing to do, because at the end of the day, I think people are going to be more likely to want to work with the agency and settle cases if they know that no one's playing hide the ball. And if the perception is out there that hide the ball is the game of choice, I think that prolongs matters that otherwise should settle. I've had experiences before I got here where the counsel's office has told me some things that weren't in the probable cause brief, and it's caused me to go to my client and take time to settle. So there's actually been benefits. There's been times where I've found out things after the fact that I wish I would have known, and neither me nor my client was particularly happy. And now I'm a commissioner, and one would think, well, you know, it's a different concern, but it's really not, because ultimately when that sort of thing happens, it makes the commissioners themselves look bad, and it makes it look like we're not committed to getting to the truth. After all, when we investigate, it ought to be that, an investigation. It's not a prosecution. Once it gets to the probable cause stage, then counsel becomes more of an advocate. But at the investigation stage, it's really more of a search for truth. And if we're searching for truth, it makes sense that of the remaining materials that the respondent wouldn't get in the administrative stage, which really isn't that much given what the current policy is, this is not causing all sorts of new documents to be disclosed. And I hate to do this. Can we have a recess for 3 minutes, Madam Chair, because I'm sort of...
Can I say something before we do
it? Sure, but I'm okay.
I just wanted to comment on something that you said, you know, why wait? All I am suggesting is that we not vote for another 2 weeks. If you want to, I am willing to agree that we won't approve any conciliation agreements in the next 2 weeks to make sure that we are not disadvantaging anybody. But, you know, odds are that might not happen anyway. In order to give people an opportunity to comment on the specific proposals that we're contemplating. I mean, it's true that we got comment from folks at the hearing saying, you know, you should give us more documents. And there is no debate at the table that we should have a written policy. There's no debate at the table that we should be disclosing exculpatory and mitigating evidence. But, you know, the devil is sometimes in the details. And in order to make sure that the policy that we adopt is the most well-informed policy, I don't see that there's any harm in waiting for 2 weeks to give people an opportunity to weigh in on it. But I will stop now so that we can have our recess.
We'll take a five-minute recess. We are actually, it seems to be the preference that we're going to take a break for lunch, and so we will resume this meeting at 1:30. Thank you. The open meeting will resume. Before lunch, we were discussing Commissioner Weintraub's suggestion that we hold this matter over for additional time for comment. In general, we regularly agree just by consensus to hold over matters when our colleagues ask for additional time to consider a matter. In this case, Commissioner Weintraub is suggesting that additional public comment would be useful to the specifics of these procedures. I hear my colleagues that we have, you know, we did have a procedure hearing a little over a year ago, year and a half ago, perhaps. But obviously, this is a very specific proposal. In fact, there are two proposals. And I, for one, think it would be very useful to get some meaningful public comment on that proposal. So normally, we just hold things over to the next scheduled meeting, which in this case is May 26th. Vice Chair Hunter.
And somebody brought up, I can't remember who it was, the possibility of scheduling an additional meeting. And over the lunchtime, I was able to confer with some of my colleagues, and I proposed having an additional meeting on Friday the 13th of May. And that, yeah, I know.
Friday the 13th.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time as any. I think the chair, I believe you said you might have had a scheduling conflict that day, so maybe Thursday the 12th in the afternoon, if that works. Works for us.
Commissioner Weintraub.
As the chair noted, we normally hold matters over as a matter of course. We don't schedule special meetings. We just put it over to the next meeting. All these meetings were scheduled based on people's calendars. If you say, you know, we have to do it next week, that's like saying we really don't want comment. We don't want to give the public an adequate chance to actually read these documents and provide public comment. We're not interested in what they have to say. We want to schedule this at the earliest possible moment, have a special session just so we can vote this out without considering public comment. I think, earlier it was said, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to disclose to the public whatever documents we have. Well, we also shouldn't be afraid to hear what people have to say before we vote on a document. What are you afraid of? Why the big rush? Who's going to be harmed if we wait for the next open meeting and give the public an adequate chance to read the documents, which are complicated, and say, you know, gee, what's in this one? What's in that one? What do we like? I think the odds are, I literally don't know what you're afraid of, because the odds are that we will get comments from lawyers who represent respondents who will say, wow, we love that proposal. That's great. But I think it's also possible that we'll get some comments that say, you know what, that's a great idea, but I have a suggestion for improving it. And I personally would like to hear that. It's only going to result in a better policy at the end of the day. And there's absolutely no downside. That, you know, if there's a harm in our waiting 3 weeks to do this, I would like to hear what that is.
Mr. Hunter?
I think as we've said earlier, we're ready to vote on it right now.
But what's the harm in waiting 3 weeks? I understand you're ready to vote on it now. I understand you've made up your mind. Don't care what anybody else has to say. I understand that.
That's not what I said. I said we're ready to vote on it right now. And because our colleagues are interested in getting public comment on this, we're willing to put it out for a week. We think that's a reasonable amount of time.
Never put anything out for 1 week for public comment. When was the last time? Come up with one example where we said we wanted public comment and we're giving you 1 week.
We've done plenty of policies since I've been here that we haven't put out for any public comment.
Most of those were pilot projects.
I don't know. I don't know.
Every AO is a week. Sometimes less.
Every AO is a week or sometimes less.
And those AOs are always put on the public record to give people an opportunity for public comment.
And now these are on the public record. There's three documents on the public record right now. And as you know, we've been talking about this internally for months and months and months. And I think one of the concerns one of my colleagues raised earlier was that OGC has some questions about the document. And that's obviously reasonable. And I think a week would give OGC ample opportunity to ask technical questions, you know, ask specific questions about the document production list or whatever. I mean, that seems reasonable, but I think a week is more than enough time.
AOs. Sorry, Madam Chair. AOs, the request is put out there in advance so that people know the topic is out there. Sometimes people comment on the request. Sometimes people comment on the responses and the request. Nobody knew that we were doing this. This is the first time that, you know, and it obviously didn't generate a lot of public attention because nobody, very few people showed up other than our loyal scribe to hear this discussion, which I think is an important discussion. I don't expect we're going to get a boatload of comments, but I think we will get some comments, and I think they will be useful if we give people an adequate amount of time. The people who are most likely to comment are lawyers who are busy people and can't drop everything because we say, oh, we are scheduling a special session in 1 week to make sure that you have the minimal amount of time so that we can give lip service to public comment without actually providing an adequate opportunity to do it. And I'm still waiting for what is the harm in waiting for the next public meeting other than the fact that you want to do it now. I understand you want to do it now, but what's the harm in what is the loss? What's the harm in waiting for the doing what we do in every other case, which is somebody's got a concern, we hold it over to the next meeting. I can think of things that you guys have held over for months while you wanted to contemplate changes to documents. And, you know, I'm talking about a couple of weeks. It's just completely unreasonable.
Commissioner McGann.
Under the directives, if commissioner wants to hold something over, it's their prerogative. So going back and forth saying, well, you guys have held stuff over, that we all know that's not really the point. the problem I see is this is a commission procedure that concerns how the commission conducts its enforcement. I come back to the fact we have had a hearing. This has been discussed. You say that every commissioner has been in favor of exculpatory evidence ever. Place has been here, well, how many years? 30 plus? Now all of a sudden, everyone finds that, oh yeah, everybody's always been in favor of this. Why is it taking this long? We have cases ongoing now, and I can't get into details because all that is confidential under the statute. And I guess you could say, what's the big deal of over 3 weeks? But, you know, who knows? Maybe there's cases ongoing, maybe there's not, where this actually is going to matter to a real respondent. Merely saying we won't sign any conciliation agreements for a couple weeks really isn't the issue, because this concerns more factual information. Second, I'm still people may file comments. They may be good. They may be bad. They may be indifferent. But part of what they're commenting on is an unknown, because unless you actually work at the FEC, half of this doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense, because it's based entirely on the perception of the commissioners and the general counsel's office in a confidential enforcement matter. So it's tough for people to file meaningful comment on some of this, particularly the issues you've raised, the third-party issue, which to me is not that big an issue because we already deal with that in Murr after Murr after Murr at the probable cause stage. So a lot of this is tough. People want to file comments, they certainly can. I'm always open for input. But, you know, unless we really open the door to all the nuances of what goes on behind closed doors, you know, we can jump up and down and talk about public comment all we want, but it's not meaningful public comment. Moreover, this policy, without getting the details, we've talked about this in executive session already, because there are issues the council wanted to address to the commission behind closed doors. Can people comment on that? No. I don't hear anyone suggesting that people can come in and listen to that discussion. You only want to hear the discussion that we've sanitized for the public on this. There's a lot of stuff here that is both public and private. Private in the sense that it is procedures within the commission, where it's the commissioners themselves that are in the best position to know what to do to solve very real problems. The problem is going to be here today, just as it's going to be here in 2 weeks from now. And it commissioner wants to hold it over, commissioner can hold it over. And once the commissioner says, I want to hold it over, the debate ceases. That's how the directives work. I haven't heard that. I've heard maybe hold it over, so we're still talking about it. But if you want to hold, you can hold. But let's be honest about what we're doing here, and what, if there are comments, what the comments are commenting on. They're commenting on a procedure that part of it's already behind closed doors, and its application happens behind closed doors. So for people out there listening to this, and just because people didn't show up to listen, that doesn't mean people aren't paying attention. This is being broadcast on the web. I know people listen, so hello all of you in cyberland. File comments, but realize when you file comments, you don't even know all the discussion the commission's had on this, because this does go to the heart of the internal enforcement procedures of the commission, which are not public. Maybe they should be. Maybe the enforcement manual should be public, but it's not. There were comments. The enforcement manual is public?
We've got an enforcement manual that's public.
It is? The entire manual is public?
There's a guide.
Oh, right. But there is a secret manual.
Right.
It's not public. Right? Can I go in my office and get it and make copies and hand it out? No. So this goes to that juncture. Pardon?
I'm willing to consider that if you want.
I'll move right now. We make it public.
I'm willing to consider it, meaning I want to go back and look at what's in it. Maybe
we'd add that for comment.
Part of it. As you know, I have long advocated that we make our penalty schedule public, which I think is one of the things that's in the enforcement manual that there's been concern about making public. If you want to, you know, go through that document and see what more we can make public, I'm happy to do that.
Okay, while we're on it, if we're going to get comment on this, another issue that arises in the sua sponte submissions. People put in a sua sponte, and then when it's served, it's not really served. They get a letter saying you did something wrong, says someone else, please respond. That, I think, intersects with this policy, perhaps. People may want to comment on a sua sponte policy. We have an interim disclosure policy since 2003. Still kind of what we're doing. There was a promise made then in 2003 there was going to be a permanent policy made in effect. That's still not done. I still haven't seen a tangible proposal to make penalties public. I've suggested some things in executive session. They've gone nowhere.
Your suggestions were to change the penalty schedule and then make it public. So that's why your proposal didn't go public, because there were not four votes for the way you wanted to change the penalty schedule.
But in that case, that was the penalty, so that would have been something that actually does become kind of something that matters. That being said, look, if you want to hold it, you can hold it. But those on the outside have to understand that you're commenting on a document that is a procedure that, if there are things that they don't think is clear, that's helpful. But a lot of this is in the enforcement process, and there's already been discussions and commission deliberation that's outside of the view of the public. So for comments, it gets kind of tricky. But with that, I just wanted to make it clear that this is not as simple as, why don't we want comment? There's a lot more to it.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have had, for as long as I've been here, an informal policy on disclosure of exculpatory information. And so you say, well, why has it taken 30 years? There was an informal policy. And as I said earlier, wait, let me finish. I let you finish. Let me finish. I said this morning that I think it is a good idea to put it in writing. I agree that without something in writing, there are, it could get implemented inconsistently. People might have different understandings of it. It is a good idea. I'm in favor of putting it in writing. I said so this morning. I still think it's a good idea. What we would be asking for public comment on are the specifics of the proposals that are, have been put on blue paper today. And there are, you may think there's nobody out there who's in a position to give meaningful comment on that, but I actually disagree with you. I think there are a lot of people who are sensitive to the issues of confidentiality when representing multiple respondents because they've done it, and they might want to think about it. And I also know, as you do, that there are actually quite a number of attorneys out there who represent clients who have worked here in the past and actually do have some insight into how the process works internally. And there are former commissioners out there who are practicing in this area. I can think of several off the top of my head. Former heads of enforcement, former attorneys from former EAs, former attorneys from the Office of General Counsel. There's plenty of people out there who are practicing right now and have that, both of those perspectives, the perspective of somebody on the outside, and they actually know how things work on the inside. I think those comments would be particularly meaningful to us. But, in answer to your, invitation, I'll take it as that if I want to have it held over, it can be held over. Let me state formally that I wish to have it held over till the next meeting, because I believe that it will be a better document at the end of the day. Maybe we won't change one comma and it'll get adopted at the next meeting. Okay, fine, but at least we will not close our ears to what anybody else who doesn't happen to work in this building might have to say on the subject.
Commissioner McGann.
Could I ask one question just to clarify something you said? You mentioned the policy and you characterized the current informal policy as an exculpatory evidence policy. Is it currently the policy of the commission that exculpatory evidence is turned over to a respondent, exculpatory in a broader sense of the word, not simply something that is direct proof that someone didn't do it, but circumstantial or impeachment evidence that would impeach a witness? Because my understanding of the current commission policy is that there is no policy to turn over exculpatory evidence. The policy is things relied upon by the counsel in the probable cause brief get turned over. But if it's not relied upon in the counsel brief, it doesn't get turned over. So to the extent that there is a policy, let's at least be clear to the public as to what the policy is before we have them comment on something that may or may not already exist.
Commissioner McGann. Commissioner Weintraub, as counsel conferring.
Council,
I haven't forgotten about your question, Commissioner.
No, I just want to say it is my understanding, that was my belief, certainly, that we do turn over exculpatory evidence to respondents, but I'll defer to counsel on that. But indeed, if there is confusion about that, that shows yet another benefit to putting something in writing, which we are all in favor of.
Not to editorialize, but if the policy is the policy, it should be an easy question to answer.
Ms. Guth?
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair, what we currently strive to do is provide information in the brief that we are relying on in support of our probable cause recommendation, and information which we don't know is already in the possession of respondents that we would want their answer to, so that when we go back to the commission and recommend probable cause or not, we have full information. So in certain cases, that would include in the brief information that may be considered mitigating or exculpatory. In some cases, there will be no such information. In many, as you know, there's only a certain percentage of our matters that reach that stage, and those that do, a smaller percentage deal with matters where we've conducted an investigation or received information from people other than the respondent that is receiving the brief. And so in many of our cases, the only information we've received is from the respondent themselves. But where we think that the respondent may not have information that's exculpatory, we try to put that in the brief so that we can get a response and include that in our overall recommendation to the commission.
Commissioner McGann.
Follow-up question. But under the statute at the probable cause stage, the statute says the Office of General Counsel recommends probable cause, and then the respondent files a brief and therefore gets the last word. I'm not following you when you talk about you put it in to see what the respondent says and then you see what you're going to do in your recommendation. The recommendation's already been made, isn't it? I mean, that's how the statute reads.
No, just to clarify that, the recommendation is not made. What the brief says specifically is that here's the information on which we are prepared to recommend, and we obviously invite them to submit to us additional information which could alter what our view is as to what our recommendation will be once we ultimately make a recommendation to the commission.
Follow up on that. So what you're saying is the initial brief is just an intent to recommend. There's a response, and then the real recommendation comes after.
That's correct.
Okay. Let me just read the statute, 437A3. The general counsel of the commission shall notify the respondent of any recommendation to the commission by the general counsel to proceed to a vote on probable cause pursuant to paragraph 4A1. With such notification, the General Counsel shall include a brief stating the position of the General Counsel on the legal and factual issues of the case. Within 15 days of receipt of such brief, respondent may submit a brief stating the position of such respondent on the legal and factual issues of the case and replying to the brief of General Counsel. Such brief shall be filed with the Secretary of the Commission and be considered by the Commission before proceeding under paragraph 4. And paragraph 4 is where if there's 4 votes, there's probable cause. But the statute says any recommendation is to be served on respondent, and they get the last word. Now, what you're telling me is they don't. You get the last word.
The brief itself is our position at the time we serve the brief. And yes, the respondent is given an opportunity to provide additional information which may in fact result in a recommendation to the commission that there's not probable cause to believe. So they do have an opportunity to present to us additional information that there's not probable cause to believe, we wouldn't at that point be receiving any additional information supporting probable cause because the only final information submitted is from the respondents themselves.
But what I'm hearing you say is that the actual recommendation occurs after the respondent files the brief, which is the inverse of what the statute contemplates. The statute contemplates the respondent getting the last word. And the respondent gets to respond to your recommendation. Now, you may wonder what this has to do with exculpatory evidence, but it has everything to do with it because it gets to the heart of the matter as to what the respondent knows and when he knows it. And if we're not following the statute at the probable cause stage, and I would suggest based upon what we've been told here today, the commission is not following the statute, we have bigger problems than exculpatory evidence. But the statute could not be clearer that at probable cause stage, the council makes a recommendation. It doesn't say just the first or initial or the, it says any recommendation that gets served and there's a response. But you're telling me there's a recommendation after the after respondent files a brief that they don't get to respond to.
Correct. What is contained in the brief is the information we have at that time upon which we are prepared to recommend to the commission that there's probable cause to believe. The respondents have an opportunity to respond to that. Subsequent to them responding to it, if they so choose, we do forward to the commission our recommendation as to whether or not there is probable cause to believe, and the commission thereafter votes as to whether there's probable cause to believe.
How does that square with the statute? I mean, I could see certainly after the respondent files a brief, counsel's free to say, you know what, they make a good point, we're not going to recommend probable cause, they've talked us out of it. The regulations contemplate that. That's why there's a reg. But the statute itself couldn't be clearer on the point, and I can't square what you're saying with what I'm reading here in the statute book.
Again, our final recommendation to the commission will not contain any additional information supporting a recommendation for probable cause. If any new information is contained within the recommendation, it would be information received from a respondent themselves and presumably information which, if anything, argues against probable cause to believe.
Then why doesn't the respondent get a chance to respond to that? If it's not that big a deal and there's nothing new, what's the harm in following the statute and letting them have the final word as contemplated by the statute?
They've already received the information upon which our recommendation is based and have had an opportunity to respond to it. This final recommendation is simply adding the layer of respondent's own response.
But if the statute contemplates the respondent having the final word, why does the council need to put a gloss on the respondent's response? Haven't they already put their own gloss on their response?
Under that approach, there would be an opportunity for the General Counsel's office to consider changing its recommendation based on the final submission of the respondent. In other words, we would be unable to reconsider what we would recommend ultimately to the commission.
That's all I have for now.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, when you were describing what the current policy is or the current practice, you say that in the brief that's served to respondents that we typically, or it's a practice of ours to include exculpatory or mitigating evidence. But that would seem to indicate that there are occasions or times and there's not necessarily a requirement that exculpatory information does get put into the brief. And in those instances where there is exculpatory information in the possession of the commission that's not in the brief, do we hand that over as a matter of course to the respondents?
If I understood your question, are you asking if we would hand it over post-brief if we received something that was exculpatory?
Well, no, I'm just saying that you say that the practice is to include exculpatory evidence or at least mitigating evidence in the brief. But it doesn't sound like that's a hard and fast requirement, which would indicate that there are occasions where there may be exculpatory information that's not included in the brief that's served upon respondent. And so in those instances, is it the commission's policy to provide that information, even though we're not relying on it or referencing it in our brief, do we still hand over that information to respondents?
Well, as I stated, this issue just doesn't come up very often, and the number of cases in which we proceed to this stage doesn't happen in a large percentage in relation to our overall docket. And so I couldn't necessarily say in every case, and I do think that because some of the points Commissioner Weintraub made earlier I think are in fact the case, we have 30 different line attorneys interpreting an informal policy in different ways. And so I imagine that different things have happened in different cases. Our goal is to try to, again, provide respondents, if we think they don't have a piece of information that might be exculpatory and could, in fact, be material to our overall recommendation to the commission, we want to provide it to them so they have an opportunity to respond to that information.
Commissioner Peterson.
If I can just add in my two cents. Obviously, this is, we won't be... I'd be happy to support supporting this policy today, but it looks like we're going to be moving on. I think for the reasons that Ms. Guth pointed out, I think that having a written policy would be extremely helpful so we don't have multifarious interpretations of what's going on. And it's also why I like the approach that that Commissioner Walther has with his document, where we define exculpatory information, but we don't say we turn over documents. Basically, the rule is we turn over documents, and then we look at the next part of the reg, or the policy, which then we withdraw certain documents. You know, for privilege reasons, for reasons dealing with we receive them from another governmental entity under an agreement not to disclose that, which gets the commission out of the business of deciding what's exculpatory and what's not, because we're probably not in the best position to determine what's exculpatory and what's not. And I think that that's one of the real virtues of the way that this is structured, because I think that that puts OGC, frankly, in a really kind of an odd position, because what's exculpatory to one person may not seem exculpatory to another, but the policy as it's drafted under Commissioner Walther's proposal would get us out of that box, and we'd eliminate certain classes of documents that wouldn't need to be turned over for the various reasons we've discussed, but it wouldn't put us in that position where we have to make calls which are better left, I frankly, for opposing counsel, for respondents' counsel to make. So anyway, I just wanted to say at this point that I'm supportive of Commissioner Walther's policy and look forward to voting on it when we get the chance. Thank you.
Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you. One quick question to follow up on the line of questioning that Commissioner McGinn was asking. At this point now, the probable cause brief, the first one where you recommend what you're going to do, does that brief contain discussions of anticipated arguments by respondents, or is that saved for the next report?
I think it probably differs by brief, but we definitely in many briefs try to anticipate what respondents' arguments are going to be, because again, we want to hear what they have to say about those arguments and get their responses to them.
Thank you. Part of my confusion, really, since I've been here on a lot of this stuff, is it is hard for me to tell what OGC's position is. And I have this old book in my office that I refer to all the time, and I get in trouble from the enforcement attorneys because I always say, please put that book away. That's an old policy. But I really don't know what the new one is, so it's a little hard to deal with. There are things in the secret book that I have now that are completely contrary to the descriptions that we've heard today and other days. I believe that they're different just with with all due respect to the way that Commissioner Weintraub believes the policies are happening. And I think that's part of the problem. And it also goes to Commissioner McGann's point of, I'm not really sure how the public is supposed to provide meaningful comment on this with so much of it kind of up in the air. And to follow up on what Commissioner Peterson said, I did hear counsel to say that there is not a hard and fast rule to turn over exculpatory evidence. And I think the memorandum that was submitted this morning from OGC reiterates that point. I mean, there are several points in here where it says it's a sort of case-by-case thing, and we have to make sure that we're not breaching confidential information and all that sort of thing. So I guess if I'm trying to put myself in the shoe of the public trying to figure this out, it's going to be pretty tough because I don't think that they're operating with a full picture of what's going on. And I don't even know what the full picture is, and I've been here for almost 3 years. One last thing is, I forgot what was the last thing I was going to say. I had another good point. I'm sure it was a very good one, but I can't think of it right this second. But just for the record, I too would be willing to vote for this right now. Maybe in the next 24 hours or so, we can think of other things that might be useful to put on the public record. So to the extent people have other information they might want to look at when they're trying to figure out how to comment on this, that potentially could be useful.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to belabor this, but this notion that, oh my gosh, how is the public ever supposed to figure out how to comment on this? We do this all the time. We've got a couple of documents that we're putting before the public. We're asking them to comment on those documents. Now, one of the virtues of having documents is that we will eliminate the confusion over what exactly is the policy or isn't the policy or should be the policy or what this attorney might believe or that attorney might believe. I completely am on board with putting something in writing to eliminate that problem. I'm 100% supported. And that we've got a couple of proposals that are in writing in detail, and people can look at those and say, is that the policy that we think the FEC ought to have based on, you know, and I assume most of the, you know, I could get comments from anybody, but I would assume that most of the comments, and I don't imagine we'll get a huge number, will be from practitioners, people who do business before the agency, and they will sit down and look at these documents and say, is that the way I think the agency ought to do business, or do I have a better idea? And if they do, I want to hear it. Maybe nobody will. Maybe you'll end up voting for exactly the same document in 3 weeks that is before you today. Fine then. You know, at least at the end of the day, we will then have something in writing, which we all want. We will have clarity. And I think that there is, you know, the only other point that I would make is that it's always been my understanding and my intent that we should produce exculpatory evidence to respondents. I've always said that to various general counsels over the years. It's always been my understanding that's what we're doing. To the extent we're not doing it, we should be doing it. And I certainly assume that that's what the written policy, whatever it is, will say at the end of the day.
So any further discussion? Commissioner Walker.
I think the important discussion, it's important for us to discuss exculpatory evidence, but this policy that I'm hoping to see the commission adopt talks about negative evidence, too. What hurts your case? I mean, that's important for a counsel to know also. And I think if we want to be fair with counsel and the commission, everybody at the probable cause stage ought to be pretty much up on exactly what that is. And so exculpatory evidence, if I look at the counsel's brief here that came in mid-meeting, there's problems hand-wringing all over the place about this policy. And, you know, it's a lot of agencies use it. They get along fine. And it's the fair thing to do. So I hope that attitude will be reconsidered. So that's just my thought. And certainly I'm ready to vote anytime.
All right. We'll look forward to public comment on these documents, and we'll hold them over to the next open meeting, where I assume we will be taking a vote on them in one way or the other and finally put something in writing. Ms. Carmona, are there any management or administrative matters?
There are none, Chair Bowerly.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.